podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Football is many things. Unpredictable, exciting, colourful, passionate, absorbing, expensive.
Venal, infuriating, exasperating, time-consuming, depressing. But one thing it most certainly is not, is a level playing field.
Welcome to the famous sloping pitch. In a week when it was revealed that COVID lockdown brought about a spate of regretted purchases, topping the list were gym equipment, carpentry tools and Emiliano Buendia.
And a week in which Joe Biden was accused of farting in front of the Duchess of Cornwall. The American president later apologised, saying, "I didn't realise it was her turn."
I thank you!
Can we get a drum kit in here?
Oh, that joke courtesy of the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Of 1940. Yes.
And Gary Neville criticised Man United's defenders after they were seen high-fiving each other after Manchester City failed to score a third goal. The players were unconcerned about Gary's comments, and next time they're going to go with the Eskimo nose-rubbing or one of those butterfly kisses when you touch eyelashes.
Experts said that a regular 10 o'clock bedtime reduces the risk of heart attacks. And I know what they mean. Match of the day winds me up as well. The volleyball that featured in the film Castaway, did you see this?
With
Tom Hanks as Wilson, the only volleyball to be nominated as an Academy Award for supporting actor, sold at auction for $230,000 after a bid of $4.2 million from Newcastle United was rejected on ethical grounds. What does this have to do with football? Well, in order to talk to Wilson and remain sane, or arguably otherwise, Tom Hanks invented the ball plinth that's now used all around the world. True story.
Oh, is that right? I forgot.
There's Wilson on a little plinth that he made out of rock.
Wilson on a plinth.
Anyway.
Also, with sad news this week with the passing of Gerald Sinstad, the great Granada football commentator and also the presenter of Kickoff on Friday nights, I think with Elton Wellesby. One of the great things about Gerald Sinstad, classic comment during the 1978 World Cup from Argentina, where the coverage was slightly delayed in coming through. And he said to Jim Rosenthal in the studio, "It's live, Jim, but not as we know it."
That's very good.
He didn't really say that. I just made it up. But it'd be good if he did.
No, one thing that he did actually say, I remember, because I looked Jerry Sinstad up yesterday after hearing that he'd passed, and saw the great clip of Dennis Law sending Manchester United down from 1974. And he was commentating on that moment for Granada, and his line was, "Dennis has done it."
All right, okay.
Which is, I was particularly interested to look at that game because I was at it with my grandfather.
Oh, were you?
Sat
really?
Behind that goal, yeah. Oh. He had a friend with Manchester United season tickets, and he was a glory hunter, and he'd given up halfway through the season. So my granddad had his season tickets, and we went to that, yeah.
Oh, very good.
And my granddad, I remember grabbing my arm when Dennis Law's back heel went in, grabbing my arm and pulling me out of the stadium because he knew it was going to kick off.
It was going to kick off, yeah. The other thing Jerry Sinstad did, and we weren't meant to be doing a whole thing on Jerry Sinstad, but during the... Do you remember the famous West Brom winning 5-3 at Old Trafford?
Yeah.
With Cunningham, Regis and Batson. And during that game in the commentary, and they left this in, he called out the Manchester United fans for their racism, which I think was probably the first time that had ever been done, one, and wasn't done again for about 30 years, so he was well ahead of his time.
Yeah, until they started kneeling down and ended racism forever.
Yeah.
So, the Premier League has apparently blocked a charitable initiative called Hashtag No Home Kits. Did you see this?
I did.
Which sounds like a charity thing to help kids whose parents can't afford new football shirts for Christmas. It's not, though. It's an idea by Shelter to raise awareness of homelessness, not home kitlessness, whereby all the Premier League clubs would wear their away strip on Boxing Day. I mean, timing, though. After all, if nothing else, Christmas is a special time for kids to get given a new home shirt that will be out of date in 6 months' time.
It is staggering, though, the whole thing, is it not?
Yeah, well, their statement said, sorry, nothing we can do. It's the rule. It's our rule that we decide on, but we don't even know how to change it. It's completely out of our hands.
Yeah, and you kind of feel that they've sat there and gone, well, yeah, I suppose we could, but you know, where will it end?
Once you kick open that door...
Where will it end? Perhaps with helping homeless people. But, you know, no, we're not doing it.
It'll be rainbow laces before you know it.
Yeah.
Anyway, before we allow ourselves to luxuriate in the finest premium gourmet truffles of the Premier League, it's time to scoff down the hairy Malteser that you found in the bottom of your tracksuit trouser pocket that is the very bottom of the EFL.
Hairy Malteser.
Although saying that, yes, that's what it is. Although saying that, Oldham Athletic have had a little break from the hairy Malteser scoffing thanks to a couple of cup competitions. One, the oldest and most revered cup competition in the world, except by top managers, of course, who routinely disrespect it by putting out weakened teams. And the other, the most reviled competition in the country, thanks to Premier League clubs insisting on jamming their under-21 teams into it against the wishes of everyone else. So, in the FA Cup last weekend, Oldham made a surprisingly spirited bid for glory away at Ipswich Town, another former Premier League team fallen on hard times, if not quite as hard as the times we've fallen on. They've grazed knees while we have some sort of anterior cruciate ligament damage requiring urgent surgery. But still, this is their third season in the third tier, which Alf Ramsey was the last manager to dig them out of 64 years ago. Last time I went there, to Portman Road, the kickoff was delayed because the roof blew off one of the stands.
Oh, yeah, that happened at Stoke once.
Yeah, my recollection is we were 4-0 down well before half-time and that it was raining and really, really windy. But anyway, Ipswich fans seemed remarkably pessimistic before this game. Evidently, they've not been taking the cup very seriously for years, concentrating on trying to scramble back to the upper reaches where they believe they belong. They'd only won one of their last 19 FA Cup fixtures.
That's a really terrible record,
isn't it? And it's precisely the sort of record that you can rely on Oldham to fix for you.
Yeah.
Sure enough, we're a goal down after 7 minutes, up against it. But then something strange happened. Oldham started getting back into the game. We got a really good equaliser and then had a penalty which would have put us in front, except it was saved. I mean, you know a penalty's going to be saved. I know you've only recently started watching them, haven't you?
I have.
So this may be news to you, but you know it's going to be saved if the players are arguing about who's going to take it.
Yes.
And sure enough.
Well, yes, and at Stoke you know it's going to be saved if we're taking it.
If you take it.
It's simple as that. Very, very simple.
Yeah. So 1-1 it finished. And so we'll have a replay at Fortress Boundary Park, where Oldham, as you'll recall, have the worst home record of any club in the country, going all the way back to 2008. Lost 6 out of 8 this season. But at least we didn't lose 7-0 like we did in the League Cup.
Yes.
The other game was in the EFL Trophy, which has had a number of mostly van-based sponsors down the years, but now is the Papa John's Trophy, which reminds me of Pizza in a Cup. Do you remember Pizza in a Cup?
Yes,
in
I
the Jerk,
do.
The Steve Martin
yes,
film.
Yes, I do.
It was a joke, Pizza in a Cup, because yeah. It's a really stupid idea, but yeah. Now you actually can get it, obviously. Pizza in a Cup, someone's invented marketed it in America, and blah,
you
blah,
know
blah.
That any stupid idea will eventually come to fruition.
Will eventually come, yeah. But they should sponsor it, don't you think? The Pizza in a Cup would be fantastic.
Yeah, that would.
Anyway, the thing that annoys me about this competition is that they kick off at 7 o'clock. It's stupidly early. I was out playing football on Tuesday, and by the time I got in, I'd missed the 2 goals that Oldham's Zach Dernley had scored to put us 2 up, but I was just in time for the 3 goals Tranmere scored to beat us.
Well, you know, I think in a way we were sort of negative Jack Spratt and his wife there, because I think 8 o'clock is far too late for a kickoff.
7:45 is when football starts.
No, 7:30 is
when... 7:30, maybe.
Yeah.
I can get back for 7:45 after the football. But anyway, we're not out of this trophy yet, though. Even though we've lost 2 out of our 3 games, it's a bit like the Champions League or only connect. It's almost impossible to get knocked out of it. Stoke have won it, haven't they? When it was the Leyland Daff Cup.
I think you're fine.
And the Autumn Windscreen Shield.
We've won it 2 times. We've won it 2 times.
have a song.
We do.
A Papa John's Trophy song.
We sing it often at Liverpool when they say, you know, we've won it 6 times. We've won it 6 times. The European Cup. We always sing, we've won it 2 times. We've won it 2 times. The Autoglass Trophy. We've won it 2 times.
Yeah. Or did you, though, win the Autoglass Trophy? Or did you win the Leyland Daff Cup?
No.
The Autumn Windscreen Shield?
No, we didn't read. Win the Leyland Daff Cup.
Anyway, we have yet another international break to endure. It's incredible, isn't it? England are playing Albania and San Marino over the course of the weekend. Albania have come on so much in recent years that they'll be turning up with a chance of second in the group. Albania used to be minnows, didn't they? It just goes to show there are no easy games in international football anymore. And then we play San Marino.
Absolutely.
But no, the reason we haven't played the games yet, obviously, but the reason I thought it was worth talking about was when Gareth announced his squad last Friday, we learned that Mason Greenwood and Callum Hudson-Odoi had both turned down call-ups. Greenwood made himself unavailable for all the games up to Christmas, asking for his international career to be parked, was the word,
really?
Until next year. And Hudson-Odoi's boots are too big for the under-21s, evidently. Now, Greenwood, has he been playing that well, really? I mean, he's been a bit of a casualty of the return of Ronaldo.
But on what grounds was he asking for it to be parked?
I don't know. I don't know.
His parents aren't taking him to Disney World.
I mean, he's only got the one cap, hasn't he, against Iceland, after which he was sent home for what the tabloids described as frolics.
Oh, yes. And you'd have thought, true.
You'd have thought, exactly. You'd have thought he'd be really anxious to take any opportunity to get back in Southgate's good books, wouldn't you? Like his fellow frolicker Phil Foden has done. Yeah. But there you go. And he pulled out of the Euros with injury, didn't he, I think. But he's only got one cap. You think, you know, you don't park your international career until you've actually bloody got one.
Yeah,
do you?
It seems very strange.
And Hudson-Odoi has been establishing himself again, hasn't he, as a Chelsea first teamer after a little while of being on the sidelines. But has he really earned the right to be sniffy about running out for the under-21s? Should players be allowed to pick and choose whether or not to play for England? You know, or should it really be a black mark going forward, for them?
That should be. But there is a sort of Chelsea-Hudson precedent for this, because Alan Hudson pulled out of the under-23s in 1970 and wasn't picked for England by Alf Ramsey ever.
I can recall it happening before. I mean, one cap wonder Chris Sutton turned down an England B call-up. Do you remember that? And then never got picked again. Mm. And he was an estimable player worth a go, I think.
Yeah.
Tim Sherwood apparently got Ray Harford to ask Terry Venables if he could have a rest at the end of the 95 season. And Venables said OK, but never picked him again. And Euro 96 was the next summer, so he missed out on that. And Sherwood was the playmaker of the champions. And maybe he wasn't quite as good as Jamie Redknapp, who did play. But maybe I just think that because Sherwood wasn't in the England picture when he could have been, you can have a different view of him looking back.
And Southgate's made it very clear that, you know, if you're willing to turn up, he'll pick you whatever you're playing like, because he's got Kane in the squad, he's got Maguire in the squad, he's got Shaw in the squad, he's got Sterling in the squad. And you just wonder, you know, surely you can't play them. They're all going through terrible runs.
And
you just think, well, if you're not going to play them, why pick them? Because what are they going to do? They can't just stand on the touchline and dance like Bez from the Happy Mondays.
If only they would.
I would enjoy that.
I mean, I just think if you're a player who can play for England, why wouldn't you? I mean, you'll regret it later, because your whole reputation will be on another level if you're an England player.
Yeah.
You could be turning down not only England, but also being a regular on League of Their Own or going on Question of Sport with Paddy Four Phones. You know? And there's something, it isn't, but it almost feels cowardly to me. You know, something like Trump getting a doctor's note claiming he had bone spurs to get out of the draft for Vietnam.
Yeah.
And the related phenomenon of retiring early to prolong your club career, I can't stand that.
No.
Shearer did it, didn't he, and Scholes and Carragher. Yeah. And if you won't play for England, why should we listen to you?
Yeah.
You know, what have you done for me lately? Yeah. You know, you selfish bastard.
Yeah, and all this in Remembrance Week. You know,
yeah, exactly.
All those young lads that went out there, they're not saying, no, can I, after Christmas, because you said it's over.
Can I park my military career until after Christmas?
I'll be available for the Second War.
Anyway, in the Big Money League, there were some notable results last weekend, weren't there? Chelsea dropped points in a home draw with Burnley. They had loads of shots, but only scored once. And amazingly, Timo Werner was out injured, and it wasn't his fault. Even Reece James failed to notch for once, even though Thomas Tuchel said, did you see this? He could kick like a horse.
Really?
Which means backwards, doesn't it?
Yeah, well,
that's backwards.
It brings us straight back to Dennis Law, doesn't it, at Old Trafford?
Oh, yeah, well, exactly, yeah. I remember going with a complaint that needn't trouble you to the doctor, but the doctor said once he'd fixed it, he'd have me pissing like a police horse. I think anyone who's been to a heavily policed game will appreciate that is the proper standard unit of piss, one police horse.
Absolutely. And also pissing outside a football ground is what it means. Exactly. Which I think we've all done.
And inside one also.
Yeah.
But Liverpool's long and beaten run came to an end against the Happy Hammers at the almost rent-free Olympic Stadium. Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson had a bit of a mare, didn't he? Cuffing the ball into his own net like a naughty toddler, making a weak-wristed attempt to stop a breakaway goal and failing to cut out another corner. That's West Ham, you see. Good at set pieces. That's put them in their place, hasn't it? Which is third, ahead of Liverpool, level with Manchester City. You know, Manchester United could really do with a manager who can get a team to beat Liverpool and then compete with Manchester City on equal terms. So you think maybe David Moyes is...
This is the way we come back, absolutely. Just on the West Ham game, Jurgen Klopp, and I'm not saying that my English is any better than Jurgen Klopp's, but Jurgen Klopp was fronted up by Rob Nothman. Did you see that?
I heard it, yeah.
Well, who was asking about why he was complaining about the set pieces, blah, 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 blah. And Jurgen Klopp said, no, I am not your puppy. Yes. It's puppet. It's puppet.
Puppet. Do you think it's puppet?
I think
that's what he was going for.
I think it's puppet. Yeah, definitely.
He is a big fan of the Muppy Show. But anyway, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's neck is still perilously close to the chopping block, isn't it, after a home defeat to local rival City? Maybe his assertion in the build-up that United was still the biggest club in the city was ill-advised, do you think?
Yes.
But not that City looked particularly riled up by it. They just did a job of work, didn't they? Making United run around without the ball, knocking in a couple of goals and then declaring, much like Liverpool declared on five a couple of weeks earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Except they just did the bare minimum. That's entertainment.
Can I very briefly bring Arsenal into the equation? Exciting week for Arsenal, I have to say. You know, everybody's relieved that they're no longer in the bottom three, or indeed bottom. But lots going on there, you know, even in an international week. Last week was Arteta's 100th game. Wonderful. And also this week, an Arsenal opera debuted, even if it's an opera.
Debuted
at the Barbican to follow numerous books, a couple of singles, a play, a documentary series, and a film. Now, okay, that doesn't help them win their first Premier League title in 18 years, but Arsenal is now the number one guest in charades.
So when you say film, do you mean the Fever Pitch film or the Arsenal Stadium mystery?
There's another one.
There's another one?
Oh, yes, of course there is. Wow. And one other thing about Arsenal, Arsenal v Watford, my favourite piece of commentary of the week was when Emile Smith-Rowe scored and the commentator said, and that's history right there, because Emile Smith becomes the first Arsenal player to score in three consecutive Premier League games under the age of 21 or 21, as he is.
Yeah.
That's not history, is it?
That's a shit stat. So, anyway, back at United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer remains in charge, even though Rio has given up on him now, hasn't he? And he's been leading the betting odds for the sack race for weeks now, but several others have somehow slipped past, haven't they?
Yeah.
Actually, it shouldn't even be called a sack race anymore, technically, as the race was comprehensively won by Cisco Munoz of Watford some weeks ago.
Well, yeah.
And Bruce of Newcastle and Nuno of Spurs claiming the podium positions, presumably.
Yeah.
But this weekend, a couple more found their services were no longer required. I don't remember this ever being mentioned before, but apparently this international break, the third one of the autumn, is colloquially known as the killing time.
Right.
And managers dread having a bad run of form leading up to it because they know that their twitchy owners know that they have a couple of weeks to fill an empty seat.
Right.
And already more managers in the top flight have lost their jobs than the whole of last season.
Yeah.
Which suggests that booing and shouting you don't know what you're doing actually does work.
Yep.
As job security was far better, apparently, with no crowd.
So if it's almost always this time of year, isn't it? Maybe what we've created here is a second, what do you call it? The glorious 12th.
The November massacre.
Yeah.
Anyway, a couple more bit the dust just this week, which means that Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard's phones have been red hot. Can they both manage in the Premier League at the same time, though? That's the question.
There's my joke out. You bugger.
Well, Gerrard got appointed by Villa this morning,
just
a few days after Dean Smith paid the price at Villa for five defeats in a row. It feels harsh, doesn't it, the Dean Smith thing? I mean, he seemed to be doing a decent job.
I think that's awful. I really don't like that because, you know what, fans always say, we want somebody who cares and blah, 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 blah. He's done a really good job. He did a good job at Brentford. He's brought some good players in. Most of them have been injured. And as we know, if you don't like the players that have come in, he probably hasn't signed them anyway.
Yeah. And Lamps, meanwhile, has been courted by Norwich after poor Daniel Farke got sacked right after getting his first win of the season.
Yes.
They let him go and do the post-match interviews about how they were turning the corner and this was the start of better things. And then they sacked him before match of the day when all those quotes were going to be on, which seems really harsh. I mean, considering he's won the championship twice by a distance in the 4 years he's been in charge.
Yeah.
And so perhaps the reason they don't quite cut it in the Premier League in between times isn't all down to him.
No,
do you think?
Absolutely not.
But Newcastle also made an appointment, haven't they?
They have.
Did you see, by the way, Steve Bruce spent some of his $8 million on a nice trip to Abu Dhabi?
I did see that. And I also noticed that England had a 100% win record before he got there and now have lost two out of three.
Well, it meant we got to see his miserable defeat face one more time.
There is that.
And now Newcastle have appointed Eddie Howe.
I
wanted to call him Ernie Howe. Because I'm a gentleman of a certain age. But because of old bubblegum cards.
Yes.
Ernie Howe, Ernie Hannigan, Coventry City.
And Ernie Howe was the one that did the flick up for Willie Carr's goal.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he said, Eddie Howe, that he was a perfect fit for Newcastle United. And I tend to agree, because since he's been born, he's never won anything, and nor of Newcastle. But good news for Ernie Eddie Howe, in that, he's got players coming through from the youngsters, because they're area under-21s only lost 6-3 at Mansfield in the week.
Well, he said, didn't he, Howe, that in his time off since leaving Bournemouth, he's been learning from Diego Simeone, apparently. So we can expect to see him refusing to shake hands at the end of games and Newcastle players throwing themselves to the floor to try to get opposition players sent off.
Yes.
And apparently he made an incredibly detailed presentation of what Newcastle should be and do to get where they want to be. And the reason they just didn't give him the job straight away is that they don't know what they're doing.
No.
But still.
I did note it, just quickly, because we'll need to take a break in a minute, but did you see Eddie Howe and Amanda Staveley at the Brighton game, where they were sat up seemingly on their own? There were three of them, and they were raised up slightly different. There was Eddie Howe with his frighteningly blonde hair and his blue eyes, and there was Amanda Staveley, just frightening. And I don't know why, but in my mind, all I could think of was the 1936 Olympics.
dear.
I'm sorry. That was what came into my mind.
Anyway, let's move on. It was announced this week that Chelsea against Liverpool on January the 2nd will mark the return of standing to the English top flight. Since 1994, grounds in the top two tiers have been required by law to be all-seaters following recommendations made by the Taylor Report into the 1989 Hillsborough disaster. Now, there's been standing in the top two since 1994, with some clubs being given dispensation before moving to new all-seater stadium. I think Stoke were one, weren't they? They had standing after the Taylor Report. And Fulham were the most recent because their promotion up the divisions took them by surprise. But there's not been any standing for the last 20 years in the top two divisions. And this has been in the wind for a little while, hasn't it? I mean, it was actually in the Conservative Manifesto in 2019, along with, I forget now, making the rich richer, that was one. That was one of their things. Not holding their own MPs accountable for blatant corruption, I think that was in there.
Yeah.
Something about taking the whole country to hell in a handbasket, something like that.
Yes, yes.
But City have installed 5,000 and more rail seats last summer to be ready in case the rules changed. United installed 1,500 barrier seats, seats with standing barriers in front, a different design. Less chance of a shin-breaking surge. But it's not, the thing is it's not, is a return to the terraces.
No, absolutely not.
Because these rail seats, people won't stand in front of them, they will stand on them.
Yes.
That's what's going to happen. I remember there used to be rail seats behind the goal at Main Road. And going up there for the Cup semi-final in 1990, just the year after Hillsborough, and after the Taylor Report came out, but before its recommendations came into effect, everyone was standing on these things, balanced on it, because you had to, because the guys at the front were standing on them. Then everyone was standing on these things. And it felt really precarious, to be honest. You were balancing up there, you weren't able to move about.
Let me get this straight. The seats are integral to the same area as the standing.
Yeah, you have to. Everyone has to have an allocated seat, whether they sit on it or stand on it.
You do stand on the seat that you're meant to stand on?
No, you're meant to stand in front of the seat. The rail,
okay.
There's a rail. You can sit on the seat, you know, to read the programme or while the sumos are doing their stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But you stand in front of it.
Oh, dear.
And I think the barriers are supposed to be integral to it because you could still have the same surge. I mean, we were talking just now about the Gerald Sinstad commentating on that United City game. Well, it's a bit of that from 1974. There was a moment in that game where Sammy McIlroy had a chance in the air, turned, shot, went past the top corner. And as the ball went, you could see the crowd, the Stretford End, and just the wave of people just surging down.
Yes.
And then it had to relax back up. And, you know,
it was really sort of dangerous then.
And look at with modern health and safety vision, you look at that now and you think, how was that but imagine a surge like that if every step has rail seats on it.
Yes,
you know, it's good. I hope I'm wrong, but I think it feels like an accident waiting to happen.
It sounds to me very much like leaving a roller skate on the stairs. It's such a bad idea, but I hope the other things do come back. I hope that, you know, the terraces dripping with piss again, that would be good, because that's going to stop those buggers that turn up in those horrible slider shoes and three-quarter length trousers.
Or you're going to get the slide value out of them.
Well, that's true.
I mean, blokes used to roll up their programme so they could piss in the pocket of your park.
Yeah,
that's why they make programmes so glossy, so they're not absorbent.
Well, they do now. They've learned, haven't they? I saw that Dion Dublin said on Football Focus, it's all seater at the moment and everything's going okay. Why go back to something that might not work? And then he said exactly the same thing 2 weeks later on Homes Under the Hammer.
Well, I went to a game at Arsenal, as I've mentioned several times, a few weeks ago, and everyone was standing behind the goal at the lowest level.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone was standing in front of their seats because, as I say, if someone stands at the front, then you know you're relying on a bloke who's doing a Saturday job for next to no money to go and tell them to sit down, and they're not going to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. If someone at the front is standing up, everyone has to stand up.
Of course. I went to Fulham to see Stoke, unfortunately, get beaten rather heavily, and it's exactly the same. I mean, all Stoke fans were standing up. In fact, most away games, it's exactly like that. I was thinking, you're given, aren't you, a 1 metre square? I think that's right for each person. And I've worked out that if you go to Chelsea and stay in that 1 metre square, it's worth £11,321. Because that's how much property is in Chelsea at the moment. And also, well done to Wolves, who, of course, are one of the teams that are going to be doing it. But they are uniquely placed, aren't they? Because they haven't finished their ground for the last 50 years.
Well, they're not in this pilot programme. Are they? Liverpool and Wolves were on the list of teams that had installed rail seats, but they're not in this pilot programme, this first pilot programme. Well, Liverpool are the away team on January the 2nd, but for some reason they've not been included. I don't know why.
Well, I just think this is the sort of thing that we should like, because we are saying that most of the changes have been shit and this would be a change back. And so
It's not a return to it's a step forward to something worse.
All right, but it's both a step forward but also a step back towards having a dog handling team at half time, and I celebrate that. And now I feel we should take a break because our guest's coming up soon. As you can imagine, a podcast such as this has an enormous team of researchers, both unpaid and unpaid. Basically, when you've been on this earth as long as Chris and I have, and have spent much of that time watching the pantomime of pain and despair that is football, you meet like-minded souls along the way and discover that the football experience for a certain type of supporter transcends club loyalties. These people are found from Pittodrie to Plainmoor, and they become your friends, your sounding boards, and some you pester, and eventually, they get dragged in here and forced to be guests. So please welcome our Watford correspondent and driving force behind the Hornet Heaven podcast, the frighteningly informed Oliver Wicken. Ollie, you're so welcome to be here. We're very excited. Now, I know that you're of a similar generation and have much that you love about the way the game used to be, and although you love the game now, there are things that kind of get under your skin a little bit about the way the game is played currently, and you're very pleasingly given us a list of those things. But first of all, I want you to talk about Graham Taylor's pants.
Ah, Graham Taylor's underpants. Really? Yeah. Yes. So I wouldn't say I'm obsessive as a Watford fan, but I do have a pair of Graham Taylor's underpants, and most people usually ask me how I came by them.
Auction, I presume.
Most people presume that I must have broken into his house and ransacked his knicker drawer. Yeah. Other people, I think they must consider me some kind of pioneer, in that years ago in the 70s, I might have gone to a game and held up a card saying, "Graham Taylor, please can I have your pants?
Yes, that'd be fantastic.
Sadly, it's a little bit more prosaic than that.
Yeah. It would fucking have to be.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly, it's a little bit more mad than that.
It's a story involving a jumbled sale, a collection from a
mugging in a laundrette,
and me giving my brother a fiver and asking for GT's undercrackers.
You gave him a fiver. You were absent. He was the proxy buyer.
Yeah, my brother collected the bin bag and sorted through it, and I just wanted
bag of Graham Taylor's stuff.
Who wouldn't want Graham Taylor's undercrackers? I don't understand
otherwise wouldn't have been available.
Yeah. Why is it a talking point?
When I first heard it, I just thought, yes, that's exactly right. I mean, that was quite a strange thing. When I went away from Stoke and had only known Stoke fans, and then met in my early 20s fans of other clubs, most of all, of course, I had no time for at all. But there were some that seemed to have the same attitude towards their club as I had towards mine, which was, yes, I love them, but actually, this is about being funny, and it's funny. It's funny to go, and it's great fun. And yes, I enjoy the games, but it's all the stuff that surrounds it, isn't it? And Graham Taylor's underpants perfectly sums that up. And of course, Graham Taylor's assistant was Steve Harrison, who had his own very particular.
Did it involve a paper cup?
It did. It did.
And you really wouldn't want his underpants, would you?
No. Well, just for any listeners that don't know, Steve Harrison's way of building team morale, I believe, and he did this for England
from the top of a wardrobe.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
No. Well, all. Or or like the lockers.
Drawers.
Well, was that he could shit in a paper cup from the top.
From a dizzy height.
From dizzy heighted furniture. And I've got to tell you, I was in the World Cup in 98 in France, and I was in Marseille with my friend James, and we were in a restaurant, and we looked over, and I said, I'm sure that's Steve Harrison, you know. And he said, I don't even know who's there. I said, yeah, it's Steve Harrison. And anyway, he could clearly see that we were talking about him, and he walked across to our table and went, yes, I shit in a cup. Which I thought was fantastic.
They should get him to advertise the pizza in a cup, shouldn't they?
You should really.
The face off.
Pizza in a cup, both before and before after.
Don't throw away the cup.
Yeah. Now, one of the things on your list, Ollie, is VAR, and that's very relevant because last weekend, the most VAR overturned goals, I think, in the history since VAR has been there, which is like 2 years. Specifically, what are your problems with VAR?
I went to the historic game at Arsenal last Sunday, the Emil Smith Rowe historic game.
Yes, the historic,
He did make history. Of a sort.
Of a sort, tiny bit. Yeah. And we had a bit of VAR there. I mean, my problem with it really is that the referee just isn't the sole authority on the pitch anymore.
Yeah.
That's the basic thing. So refereeing decisions used to be made by one bloke on the pitch in front of everybody, and it was instant, and the decision was final.
And that one person was then the focus for all the
hate and bile.
Disrespect.
But now we know that there are people in his ear. So we know they're invisible.
So there's no point in shouting at him, unless you can shout louder than the earpiece.
And your voice carries to Stockley Park.
Well, now that's interesting to me, because I don't think this Stockley Park place existed before. And I think whoever's in charge of VAR has gone, we've got to make it sound like it's a really important, clever place.
It's a mythical place.
Make it sound like Bletchley Park. Make it sound like Alan Turing's there, working out if somebody's offside.
Well, it's actually just round the corner from Osterley Park, which is where we used to play football on Sunday mornings.
Where you missed that header when I crossed it for you.
It was, yes.
Yes, indeed.
Why do we always bring that up? But there are always invisible people in the referee's ear, and that just undermines his authority, your knowledge that there is someone else who is sitting in adjudication.
It also undermines your enjoyment of it while it's going on, that you have no focus for that. You have no focus for that anxiety or about whether that's a goal or not. My problem with VAR is that the fallibility of the officials is always part of it. The injustice of it going wrong is always part of it. It's part of the experience. And there's something awfully sort of sanitised about, you're getting these things exactly right. It doesn't feel like justice to me. It feels like a nuisance.
Well, I mean, it's a sport. It is not a science, you know. And then the whole thing is, you kind of feel that these people that want to make it as antiseptic as you say and as perfect as you say, then you kind of feel at some stage it's going to be a conversation where somebody's going to say, the ball's too round. You know, it bounces all over the place. How can that be right? The best players can't do something with something like that. You know, it's this constant tinkering supposedly to perfect the game. The point is, the imperfection's what makes it interesting.
And one of the things about football, that one of the life lessons it teaches you is that nothing's fair. Nothing's fair. You know, that's one of the things. The strengths it gives you for the rest of your life is, you know, it's nothing's fair. So, you know, you have to learn to get on with that.
And my problem is that it's gone throughout the whole game. So in a match you're watching where they have got the VAR technology, the referee is undermined. But even in matches where the VAR technology isn't there, just the fact that there's now a higher authority has undermined the referees in games, even in the Harrow and Sunday.
I can imagine because people are now saying, if only there was VAR, if only there was goal line technology. Goal line
and people
technology.
Do, don't they, in the games, jokingly make the TV rectangle to make the referee change his mind.
And I am sure when goal line technology came in, there was an argument that said, you are distancing the game from the game played in a park, the game played in a car park, the game played
anywhere. That's one of the sort of magical things about watching football being played at the highest level is it's the same game that you play.
Yeah.
It's the same game that you play on a Tuesday night still.
Yeah.
You know, and with VAR it can't be because you can't have that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think there's a difference in the VAR to the cricket, for instance. I think the DRS system in cricket has made the experience of watching cricket, particularly on television, much, much better because I think principally because the area of fallibility for an umpire is so much larger than it is for a football referee or a football linesman. And, you know, to the extent that you think that the umpires at cricket are actually interested to see whether they're right or not.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They'll look up at it and think, and they've actually got better as a result of seeing where the ball tracker sends the ball. But in football, these hairline decisions that go one way or another, that's part of the game. That ought to, you know, that trying to erase that is a futile and heartless
pursuit, I think. And the other thing about comparing cricket with football, Ollie, is that actually watching those replay decisions helps me understand the LBW rule better. Whereas watching the VAR decisions on offside makes me have no idea what is offside and why anymore.
Yeah, and it's the marginal gains. You've talked about marginal gains as a theme. I mean, the need for, I don't know, Premier League players to trim their armpit hair a bit more these days or clip their toenails or even just have narrower laces.
Well, that's the ridiculous thing about this year, this season over last season, where you can be offside with a shoulder, but last season it was the whole arm. Mm. And this, it's like only the shirt now.
The serious point is that they need to work out their margins of error.
Yeah.
And
you said to me about the, which we talked about last week, the breath thing. Mm. And actually, what was it you said?
Oh, it's a part of the body with which you can score a goal.
Yeah.
Because you could blow,
you could
the,
blow
ball
the ball in.
Exactly.
Well, but then the crowd can suck the ball
exactly.
in. So
the
you know
does
what?
Every week. So.
and talking about marginal gains, surely some sort of boot that isn't really visible next to the grass.
Or that just is exactly the same green as the grass.
Yeah.
Then it would
that's kind of what I meant. Yeah, exactly.
Camouflage is what you're talking about, not invisible.
Well, you know, I'm a simple child.
And obviously you don't understand technology.
The other thing about VAR is obviously the delay in the decisions, which everybody hates.
Yeah.
I was thinking back, and Nick, this is a game that you and I went to years and years ago, which was that I did enjoy waiting for a decision once, and that was the FA Cup quarterfinal at Arsenal.
Highbury
against Watford in 1987, and the story is that there were a couple of minutes to go. Watford were winning 2-1. They were going to get through to the semi-final, and Arsenal had a corner. The lino flags for something in the area. The referee waves play on. We go up the pitch. Luther Blissett eventually puts the ball in the net, and Tony Adams slides into the posts and smashes his shins, which is always pleasing. And we think we're through. It's 3-1. We're in the semi. But the referee goes and consults the linesman.
Yeah.
And this is it. It's all or nothing. Because if Arsenal get a penalty, they're obviously going to score it. They're obviously going to win the replay, and they're going to go through. And we're either in the semi-final or we're out of the cup, and it's all on the referee's consultation with the linesman, and we're holding our breath, and he gives the goal. And it's genuinely one of the best moments of my life, and I loved it, but it was unique. Mm. And now we get things like that. It feels like every week that there's all-or-nothing decision. It's going to go one way or the other. It's either a goal or it's a penalty to the other team.
Yeah. But the thing about that was when those things happened, and they're always great because there's always that running over and the players running with him. It's like kiss chase. They go towards the linesman. No, lad, don't stay back there. And then the great thing about it was the linesman would say something and the referee would turn around with absolute certainty and think, but we still didn't know if it was right or wrong.
No.
It was just that those two people had agreed. Norman Burtonshaw, who was a very famous referee in the early 70s, in a cup final, there was dispute over a penalty and they were all going to speak to the linesman. And he just, in his book, he says, so I just went across to him and said, nod your head, son. And he nodded his head, it's penalty, thank you very much.
Well, there was that famous consultation after the Jeff Hurst goal in the World Cup final, wasn't it?
Yes.
The guy went over to the Ukrainian, Russian
Which language
linesman.
Were they speaking?
I'm not sure that they were. They just seemed to be nodding to one another.
Yeah. Mm.
But there was that wait then, wasn't there? And there was that point for a goal, that same...
Yeah.
You know, so a delay in a decision isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it ought to be a rarity.
Yeah.
It oughtn't to be three times a game.
But as you say, in that situation, you can see the person who you have to vent your anger at.
Yes, yes.
So that's something, isn't it?
Well, it's part of the spectacle, yeah. isn't it, that's being removed to Stockley Park, the part of the spectacle of what you're watching.
Yeah.
Two other things that I was very interested in that you put on your list. And by the way, can I say you're much the most prepared guest we've ever had? In fact, you're much the most prepared person we've ever had.
Well, I found it hard to narrow it down to 10 shit about football.
Yeah, yeah, that is absolutely true.
But I've got one thing that's less shit about football. Well, we can come to that later, maybe.
Well, it's not really in the vein of the...
He's teasing.
There's one thing they did, which was the back pass rule that the keeper can't pick it up, which they brought in 1992, actually. Mm-hmm. So football began in 1992 this new back pass rule. And it's I think it's great. It's just that it removed a really boring part of the game. But it's also introduced this jeopardy of players that were expert in using their hands now having to use their feet. Yes. And it still gives comedy gold with Allison and Edison even today. But on the 15th of August 1992, it provided comedy gold. Well, it didn't feel like that at the time, but at Watford. The very first game of the season, under the new rule, Watford kicked off, passed it back to Perry Suckling.
Oh.
Got his feet in a tangle. The Millwall player got the ball off him and put it in the net. Yeah, yeah. So in the very first minute, there was comedy gold.
Well, I this is a theory I've never shared before, and it's almost certainly untrue. But I believe that the changing of
don't
the back...
Don't pick it up.
The changing of the back pass rule launched Ian Wright's career into the stratosphere, because he scored so many goals that first season by just chasing everything down, because people would just panic all the time. And the amount of times in that first season, if you remember, how keepers would go half down with their hands and then suddenly go, oh!
Right, I'm not sure how much to believe of what you guys say here, actually, because I was listening to you earlier, and you said that Mason Greenwood had parked his England career. Well, surely he has it valet parked for him.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. There must be somebody who can do it for him. Now, I'm interested. There are two things that I really liked on your list, particularly liked. I like them all. But fans that think they're coaches now, I think that's a good one. Tell us exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah, what I mean, one of my pet hates is when you hear fans saying that a manager was tactically naive.
Yes!
I loathe the word naive more than anything else. I don't know who introduced that, whether it was Hansen, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's like been picked up as a clever way to say stupid, or a clever way to say bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Where you know, I'm picking on him for no reason, Jermaine Genus will say something is naive. Yeah. And then you look at Jermaine Genus and he's the most naive-looking bloke.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if you go to a football ground, nearly everybody in the crowd is tactically naive. They haven't got a clue what's happening.
How many of the people in the crowd have ever had to put a team out to do anything?
So I blame the computer games like Football Manager and FIFA, and it just gives the crowd the confidence that they could be doing the job that someone who's been in football all their lives has been trained to do it and has got coaching badges.
Yeah. But even if you could have a tactical idea that would work, the idea that without a football career behind you, you would be able to man-manage those people into doing what you said is just laughable.
Exactly. And I have had, I'm not going to pull out the child that sat near me that said it, but it was my son Harvey. I'd say, what do you know about it exactly? He'd just say, excuse me, I took Burton from the conference to winning the Champions League, which is funny, except I kind of think that they mean it. Don't tell me what a long, hard season is. I'll do one in nearly 12 minutes.
Well, and if real football won't do it for you, then, you know, fake football.
Yes.
So personally, fall back on. Personally, I freely admit, after 50 years of watching football, I'm none the wiser.
No.
Absolutely none the wiser about how things happen, how matches change. And I really don't want to know. I mean, it's like a magician. You don't want to know how they do the tricks. I want to be filled with awe and wonder, whether it was the manager in the changing room having a bit of a pop, giving them the hairdryer treatment, or whether someone pushed the right back 5 yards up the pitch.
Well, you will sometimes see, won't you, on a match of the day or on Sky, when you watch a game, they'll go to a pundit who will you know, draw little moving circles around a particular player and tell you what they've done and blah, 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 as though there's understanding. But there's always then 20/20 hindsight there, where they've seen it's yeah. like they've seen a thing and they're describing the thing. It's not like they could have invented that thing. You know, particularly last weekend when United played City, they were all about the United fullbacks being drawn up the field and the space behind them.
Yeah.
And you can see that, you know, after it's happened.
Exactly, but, you know, in hindsight, yeah, I think, exactly. is the phrase. Yeah,
yeah, but the idea point. That, you know, that this is your yeah. Tactical acumen.
It's like saying, exactly. And what Hurst has done there, he's hit it just at the bottom of the bar to make sure that it drops just behind the line. Now, these things don't happen by accident. He'll have been practising that.
On the training field. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. But funny about, I mean, we're talking about that, talking about tactical naivety, et cetera, pardon me. Harvey, again, my son, to be fair, he does love his football and does watch an awful lot of it, and you know he would tell me that if you watch the German equivalent of Match of the Day, it's far more tactical. You know, they'll do, you know, proper, not just looking at that game, but look at different games, which they do occasionally do on Match of the Day. And he said he saw a great thing about Jadon Sancho, which obviously they'd done subtitles on, and how he changed from season to season and what Dortmund had done to his game and blah, 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 blah. And you just think, wouldn't it be good if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer watched that? Well, you do, because you know, they've noticed it, and maybe it could help. Maybe it could help him.
Mm. I think maybe he watched a couple of Dortmund games when Sancho was on the bench and thought, he looks good there. He looks good.
Yeah.
That's a good place for him.
Yeah. I've never seen him make a mistake.
or have a happy face.
Yeah.
I've always wondered about coaching. I watched a player called Gary Porter at Watford from the 1980s through to 1990s. And I watched him and I thought, he hasn't got better. He hasn't got better in 12 years. He keeps doing the same thing. And he was great, you know, he is a legend, but he just never really got better.
Yeah.
And he thought, isn't that a miss?
But do you think that's a case of maybe, you know, he made it very clear to each manager, boss, it doesn't matter what you say, I'll do what I do, you know. And you can imagine they get some sort of tactical click. All right, everybody over here, Gary, you can do what you want. Right, lads. I mean, there must be players who are uncoachable for various reasons, either an incredible amount of talent, an incredible amount of pig-headedness, or a very limited but effective way of playing.
But maybe over the 12 years, the course of Gary Porter's 12 years, maybe what he was covering up with his youthful athleticism, he was actually, as his athleticism deteriorated, he was making up with an ounce more nous.
Ooh,
you know,
yeah. Maybe there was marginal gain.
There was
in
a
nous.
Level,
yes.
Overall.
Should he have been concentrating on nous, or should it have been guile?
That's just a very naive question.
surely that's the whole thing about marginal gains. You want a little bit of nous, a little bit of guile, just a little bit of everything.
Isn't that the kicks a song, got isn't that song in Oliver?
Like, yeah, a little bit of nous, a little bit of guile. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and where
yeah.
does wiliness fit in? Because you can be a it's wily
a
striker.
Thing.
I think strikers are mainly wily, but occasionally you get a wily defender. I think wiliness...
John Wiley.
Well, yes, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think wiliness is cheating, isn't it?
Ooh.
That's what I've always thought wiliness was.
I think it's frowned upon ethically.
It's the same as he's been very clever there.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And you think, well, not that clever. Final thing, actually, just while we're talking about VAR, and you know, you're here and you're a Watford fan. Last season, we played you in the league, and one of the most amazing decisions ever seen on a football pitch happened. Would you like to talk us through it? Oliver.
Okay, I'll probably be talking it through from my perspective rather than your perspective.
Okay. Yeah, I won't give my perspective, but I imagine it'd be the opposite.
And this wasn't a VAR thing, was it?
No, it wasn't.
This was a goal line technology thing.
What?
So, as I remember it, maybe a little bit patchy, but as I remember it, Tom Cleverley had a shot.
Very good shot.
It hit the underside of the bar and it came down. And then it bounced out and the goalkeeper went after it. He seemed to catch it, but he may have crossed the line. And then when he came back onto the pitch, João Pedro barged him over the line.
Yes.
And so there was sort of, I think there were three points at which the ball might have gone over the line.
Yes.
And the referee got a buzz on his wrist or whatever he got. And he didn't know at which point the ball had crossed the line. So I think he guessed that it was the first time, which meant that when João Pedro barged the goalkeeper over the line, the goal had already been scored. So it was completely opaque as far as I was concerned. I couldn't tell.
Well,
what
we
was
have
going
now.
On.
Do we not have a perfect chance to show how games can be seen from different points of view? So Tom Cleverley's hit the ball. Gunn's made a fantastic save, tipped it onto the bar. It's come down, and we thought it might have crossed the line. He grabs it. Referee turns away to run back because, you know, game's starting off, running towards it back to the game. João Pedro barges Gunn into the goal. And he falls over, obviously thinks it's a free kick. Referee, facing the other way, gets the buzzer on and turns around, gives a goal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, different ways of looking at things. And the truth of the matter is, if there wasn't Dole Lend technology, and or equally VAR, if there'd been in that case, then there wouldn't have been any problem at all.
Yeah, creating a problem.
Yeah,
creating a problem, wasn't there?
It's a shame. It's a shame there wasn't goal line technology in 1990 for the FA Cup semi-final, where Nick Henry of Oldham had a shot, as you say, it came down off the bar, down arguably behind the line. And, you know, you have two different perspectives. One, the Oldham fans obviously clearly thought that was a goal.
The truth.
And the other, the referee, who was a Manchester United season holder. Season ticket holder, rather. Clearly thought it hadn't.
So. Was he really a season ticket holder?
You were allowed to do that in those days.
Were you really? Yeah. I've got a feeling Chesterfield might have beaten Middlesbrough as well in the semi-final with a similar decision. But, you know, it's all in the past now, and we've all got over it. It was the second goal that you scored that I thought was particularly unfair that night. But anyway, that's fine. Oliver Wickham, thank you so much for being here. Ollie's podcast, Hornet Heaven, is a wonderful thing to listen to. And thank you all for listening to the show. Don't forget to subscribe if you possibly can, and tell all of your friends and indeed your enemies and strangers and just people that you see, you know, maybe on a train or in court. I'm not judging anybody. And, you know, just so listeners know, I want to make a statement. You know, if you have been affected by any of the comments on this podcast and believe that your team has been picked on, don't worry, because there'll always be another team next time. Now, the Famous Sloping Pitch is an equal opportunities podcast, but maybe harsher on teams that believe themselves to be more equal than others.
Sports Social Podcast Network.